Okay, we are recording the review lesson for Malachim Aleph Part 2, as opposed to Part 1. Part 1 I hope many of you will eventually get to, if you haven't done so already. It's the fall semester 2017, coming into 2018. Good grief. What is that? The numbers are getting out of control. The lesson will divide itself into two parts. Initially, what we will do is that we will talk about the general exam stuff, for the exam technique, etc. And hopefully, after that, we'll go through the review sheet point by point, just to give some of the Rosh Prakim. I would say to you, if you have the handouts, then the expectation obviously is not that, you know, you sort of go through every handout at this point. I don't think that's possible. If it is, then, you know, do it, for goodness sake, but I would not ask you to do that. But look at the handouts. You've got almost on every page a summary, right? Each handout usually contains a summary of what the handout is about, and that in itself is extremely helpful to review the particular material. Okay, so the handouts that you got are really important. Don't ignore them. Alright, Aviva, you're here. Good. Now, in terms of the general exam thing, I just want to make this very clear, and I apologize in advance, that for reasons that are really unknown to me, your exam has been fixed for a Friday afternoon, 12 till 2, which is kind of, you should be aware of. It sort of negates my story, which I like to tell, about the girl who decided to travel to Israel 2 hours after her exam was finished, the exam she did for me. And getting to JFK 2 hours after the exam was over was, to put it very bluntly, unless you are a Trekkie, if you know what a Trekkie is, a Star Trek person, you might have made it by, you know, that kind of means, but under normal circumstances, it was impossible. And instead of getting an A, which she should have done, she ended up with a D. She did the exam in 10 minutes, ran out of the room, because she had to get her plane to Israel. Moral of the story is, do not do that, but of course, this is a Friday afternoon, so I'm assuming not going to happen. But I would say to you, if you've got to get home, then don't feel pressurized. This is what I'm upset about, that, you know, you're finishing exam at 2, and Shabbos is 4:30. There's a certain amount of pressure to finish as quickly as you can, but I would say to you, try your best to give the exam as much time as it needs. And I can only apologize from my point of view. This is something I'm not actually responsible for, but we'll have to work with what we've been given. Yeah.
I don't know if anyone has any other finals that day, but everyone agrees they beat the completion up by an hour.
So that's something which I cannot make that decision. You have to speak to Dr. Katz. If you get the okay from Dr. Katz, then that's the way to go. And my guess is there are other finals. They either do the Friday, what I call the Friday shtick, or the Sunday shtick. At least the Sunday shtick, you don't have the pressure of getting anywhere before Shabbat. So again, what may happen is that I may actually not be here for that particular event, because if I left this building at 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon, I actually would not get home in time for Shabbos. It's physically impossible for me to do so. So I've already asked that somebody will be in situ, which I suspect when you come in, you know, just check where the exam will be held and whatever. Then at that stage, I hope there won't be too many questions, and, you know, the exam is pretty self-explanatory in terms of the questions themselves. Just a little bit of discussion about the actual exam. 5 out of 6 questions. Some of you have been through this before. Sarah, you can take a little nap because you've heard all this before. 5 out of 6, please don't be brave or foolhardy, is the word I would like to use, and do 6 out of 6, because that will, you know, it may make you feel good, but it's not going to in any way enhance your chances to do well. 5 out of 6 is what you are required to do. The 6th question will have a line through it. My line, you probably will never see it, but from my point of view, I cannot then go and evaluate all 6 answers. I'm just not going to do that. Don't have the time to do it. We have 72 hours to grade papers, no time to start doing that sort of thing. So I would say to you, please, please do the 5 out of 6, and then at that point, Shabbat Shalom, you've got, okay, and that's the way to go. Again, basic requirement, please make sure you read every part of every question. It always upsets me when somebody hands in a paper and has not read part C of a question. And if you haven't read part C, even if you do A and B brilliantly, I can still only give you 2/3 of the points. So instead of getting 19 out of 20, you end up with 13 out of 20. And that's frustrating for me, because I know you know the answer, but you just haven't been thorough. And part of the idea of the test will be to make sure you look at this carefully, thoroughly, and do what you're supposed to do. Again, if you find that you can answer A, B, and C in one paragraph, tell me what you're doing. You know, just add a little note to say I'm answering A, B, and C in one shot. But normally you would answer in separate paragraphs. Most of the answers will be short or long paragraph answers. Please do not write on the covers. You know, you'll get these blue books or whatever, these booklets, blue or pink or whatever cover they have this year. Don't write on the outside except to put your name on the front. And if it's book one, as part of a series of book two and maybe book three, just make sure which number booklet it is, put that on the front. But please do not write on the covers anything else. Young lady, believe it or not, I should have kept this paper because it was brilliant, but really did not enhance herself to me. Even though it was a brilliant effort, she wrote the whole answer on the back cover, starting on the back cover inside and finishing the answer on the back cover outside. Remarkable. With 1 millimeter to spare at the bottom of the back cover on the outside. Why she did this, maybe she was into conservation and did not want to use another booklet. Please don't be so conservationist about it. They give you all these booklets. Even one word to carry over to the next booklet, don't hesitate. Use another booklet. I say that because I think it's really important. I would also say to you, again, if you do want to write on both sides of the page in the booklets, that's fine, but I would prefer if you wrote on one side only, because it does show through from both sides. The paper every year seems to get a bit thinner, and the booklets seem to get, for want of a better description, a bit cheaper. And therefore, that's the problem. So if you are going to write in these booklets a clear answer, then maybe just do it on one side of the page. Stick to the margins. You know, presentation is part of it. Okay, if I get a sloppy piece of work, then my feeling towards it will be also relatively negative. And if I get a nice presentation of something which looks, you know, worth reading and is presented well, then I am much more likely to treat it with the respect it deserves. Yes?
But if our handwriting is not pretty,
try your best. I understand, and whatever it may be, try your best. Okay, I'm going to say that. Yeah, you know, I've had a whole range of handwritings over the years, so you know, I'm sure it'll be fine. The request is to use black or blue ink, not as one student many years ago, who's probably now a grandmother, used bright pink or yellow, phosphorus yellow. That was an interesting one, because you couldn't actually read that in daylight. You had to, it was like invisible ink. You had to read it under the covers at night. Remarkable piece of work, but again, not one of my favorite marking, grading experiences, but was certainly an interesting paper. Don't use all of these incredible colors. Stick to black or blue. If you want to use a pencil, I have no problem with that, but I would prefer a blue pen or a black pen. And if you're not sure about what you've written, just put a line through it. And, you know, don't start erasing or anything like that. Not necessary. Just put the line through whatever thing that you're erasing, you're sort of, you know, ruling out, and continue writing after that. In terms of answering questions, if you want to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's fine. But if you want to do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, that's also fine. Okay? And 5, 3, 2, 4, 1, or whatever combination of numbers, absolutely up to you as to which order you answer the questions. Okay? I want to make that clear. Again, every question, read the question carefully. Okay? Most questions have at least two parts, some even three parts. And I want to make sure that that is drummed into you before the exam, so that you don't miss out any part of any question in your answer. Okay? Even if you just write one word to answer one part of a question, it's more likely to get you some points than writing nothing. Okay? So I want to make that really, really clear. Trying to think in terms of the books. This is important. The Judaica Press, the one that I've been encouraging, is not acceptable in the exam, but you can bring in a Hebrew-English text. So if you have a JPS, if you have the Art Scroll, the big green one, right, which is literally a translation, Hebrew-English, that's fine. If you have any other version, Koran, but I would say not the Judaica, the one that we've been using, and not the Art Scroll with the commentary. Can't really allow that into the exam. What I can allow is obviously Hebrew only, Mikraot Gedolot, that will be fine. If you have your own copy of any of those particular books and you want to highlight certain psukim, that's also to be encouraged, because one of the things I'm looking for in the exam is the use of text. Okay, I want to make it absolutely clear. When you give an example, you're talking about Achav and the paradox of Achav. One of the areas of paradox is that it says he was, the king of wherever he was, Aram, came to him and took away the thing, Asher Chafetzbo, I think it says, the thing which he delighted in, the thing which he really considered precious, that expression. And if you use that expression and you explain that's referring to his own private, personal Sefer Torah, then that embellishes the answer to your question about the paradox of Achav. On the one hand, he's a man who denies the essence of worshipping one God, and yet he was so attached to his own personal Sefer Torah. Okay, and he didn't see that as a contradiction, whereas, of course, we do. We see it as very much a contradiction. So again, using text, using those quotations. I'm not looking for long chunks. If you want to write it in English, it's absolutely fine. Make sure it's clear what you're writing. The text, you know, put it in speech marks, inverted commas, whatever, that sort of thing. But use of text will make me a very happy, professor, rabbi, human being, okay? Because when you do that, I know that you've read the text, you've looked at it, and it's registered itself on your mind. Alright, any questions? This is the boring part of the lesson, but I have to go through all this. Trying to think what else I need to tell you. Yes.
So we could use hypothetically like an Art Scroll Tanakh that has
yeah, the green, the big green one.
The big green Tanakh, that's yeah. Fine, but not just the
not the one with comments. Correct. And the idea, obviously, I mean that's like bottom line. If this was a graduate exam, I would not even allow to use Hebrew English. I would insist on Hebrew only. So you'd bring in, you know, Mikraot Gedolot, and that would be it. But undergrad, I can be a bit more flexible, which is what I want to be, because I'm not here pushing you so much on the text, but pushing you more on the context, if that makes sense. That was very, I like that. I'll just save that phrase for another time. Not the text, but the context. Yes.
We can bring in a Hebrew English Tanakh, but not a Hebrew English something with a function.
Correct. So no Judaica. And a Hebrew only would be fine. I have no problem with that.
So a Hebrew only that had a function in it, also no. Right.
No go if it's any translation wise, right? If you're able to deal with the Mikraot Gedolot yourself, then you know, good luck to you, because I would encourage that as something you can do and bring in a Hebrew only Mikraot Gedolot.
And it has a
fashion. Correct.
Even if she's Israeli?
Yeah, you're lucky.
My reading comprehension is not excellent.
Right. So there's no guarantees about the people who've been lucky enough to be born in the land of Israel to in terms of dealing with Hebrew-only text. You know, I'm not here to grade you on your text skills. That's a different concept completely. I'm here trying to get you to learn Novi, which I hope we've achieved. All right, now, I think that's more or less what I wanted to say in terms of the exam. Yes?
What if we, like, say, oh, there's this idea that, like, say, for example, we did the contradiction when it says that what was precious to him, and then it says, and then we say, someone says somewhere that it was his Torah,
right.
We don't say who said it.
Not a problem. Again, undergrad level, my concern is that you should know the thought. Doesn't necessarily have to be who said it, right? Which I'm very, very happy about, because, you know, it's enough to me that if you remember the concept, that is more than enough. Okay, again, at grad level, I would say that if you're quoting a Rashi comment, please tell me it was Rashi. Please tell me it was Radak. Please tell me it was whoever. But at this level, not required. But if you do that, then you know, you get kind of a hug, or a virtual hug in this case, from me, if you see what I'm saying. So that's good, because to mention the text is always a good thing, and the name of the rabbi who said whatever he said. So I'd leave it at that. All right, now, in terms of the review. Okay, deep breath. Here we go. Yeravam's basic error of judgment in making the agalim. So we are talking at the beginning of chapter 12, or really towards the end of chapter 12, and obviously the split of the kingdom has taken place. We know, and again, a lot of the basic, what we would call pshat, is what I sort of not even going to go through now, but I expect you to know the story. I showed you in the Judaica that he does that very well. You know, if you haven't got a copy of that, but maybe you can photocopy or take a picture, whatever, of his introductions, because they're very helpful. And, of course, by the time we get to the end of chapter 12, Yeravam has established his kingdom in the north of Israel. It was based on a prophecy, right, please remember that he was told he was going to become king by a gentleman called Achia Shiloni. That's in chapter 11, the chapter before we started learning this part of Sefer Melachim. But, nevertheless, chapter 12 is where it all happens. And one of the big things which I think we need to understand is that Yeravam has, for want of a better word, a few challenges. Challenge number one is that his own perception of kingship is, in fact, not quite what was expected when he was made king of the northern kingdom. All right, Yeravam is a person who, on the contrary, wants the northern kingdom to be Jewish, but not in the same way as the southern kingdom. The whole idea was to move away from Yerushalayim. And in order to move away from Yerushalayim, you've got to establish in the north of Israel a parallel Jewish universe. Okay? So like today, if there would be a second Jewish country, second country of Israel, you know, established somewhere round about Florida, that would be kind of interesting. Somewhere in that part of the world, you know, where the weather is, well, actually probably be a bit too hot down there. Trying to think of a nice place apart from Eretz Yisrael, but you know, whatever. And that would be, again, a discussion about the parallel universe, what it would be like to be in a second place, which also has the influence of Jewish custom and practice. For Yeravam, it was a matter of establishing his own identity, and therefore, one of the things he did was to bring agalim, right, calves, the sort of word that we know from the Torah, egel, zahav, golden calf. Now, of course, in the Torah, it has a very negative connotation. So the question was, how could Yeravam do that? What was he doing? So then we had two suggestions. One was the Abarbanel. I'm mentioning just the name so that you should know who said it, but as I said, you know, just the idea is really more important. Abarbanel says very simply that Yeravam was from the tribe of Yosef, from the tribe of, I think it was Ephraim. And the symbol of Yosef was the Bechor, was the ox. So therefore, having these images in one in the far north of Israel, in the place called Dan, Dalad Nun, and one in Bethel in the middle of the country, all in the northern kingdom of Israel, all of that would be to enhance, as it were, his image, the image of his tribe to the Jewish people, right? Even though it was presented in the form of golden calves. That's what they're called. They're called calves. And they are definitely idolatrous, certainly from the point of view of the way they appear. Was Yeravam intending to serve idolatry at the beginning? That's a very sort of debatable question, but it certainly comes out very clearly that's what he eventually does. So his basic error of judgment is that certainly when it comes to the Agalim, either, as I said, according to the Barbanel, he wanted to use them as this image of his tribe, or as the Malbim said, I explained this and we looked at it, that he brought these things from Egypt. He had spent a lot of time in Egypt and he saw these two images as part of an Egyptian festival, two festivals in the year, which were celebrated in two different parts of the country. And he got the idea from Egypt that coming to Eretz Israel also bring some sort of religious practice, one to be in the sort of far north of the country, and one to be in the middle of the country. And to add to that, the idea is that even for the ones who are more observant, if they are now not allowed to go to Jerusalem because there's a cutoff in the middle of Eretz Israel, they can't go down. Yeravam put guards between north and south of Israel. What happens is that the people still want to do Aliyah L'Regel, they still want to make a trip, because Jews like to travel in that sort of circumstance. If you've ever been in Israel, Chol HaMoed Sukkos, you know what I mean. Traffic jams in Yerushalayim are unbelievable. And the reality of it is that in order to do that trip, they want to go somewhere. So in this case, people from the middle of the country will end up going to Dan, which is right in the north, you know, so the Hermon up that way, and people from the north would then travel to the middle of the country to go to Bet El, which is right in the middle of the country. So between the two places, this was the theory. As we say, the problem was that it was a total disaster, because almost immediately it became idolatrous in worship, and Yeravam had this aspiration that we saw, that he wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. And of course, he's not from the tribe of Levi, he's not a Kohen, but doesn't seem to stop him, doesn't seem to bother him. And by the time we get to chapter 13, he's actually doing some sort of service, some sort of avoda on a Mizbeach, which he himself has established. Let's just throw in the parallel holiday of Sukkot, which for the northern kingdom was established in the month of Cheshvan, not in the month of Tishrei, so that again the northern kingdom could be seen to be observing Jewish practice, but in a parallel universe, not quite on the same days at the same time, but doing the same observance of mitzvot, essentially undermining the whole observance of the mitzvot in the process. Because of course, if you're not keeping Sukkot in Tishrei, then you're not keeping Sukkot, period. But that was not what Yeravam was trying to achieve. He wanted everybody to feel connected, but different. Okay? Pseudo-Judaism. That's an expression I once coined for Yeravam's view of the world. Anything else that we can say on number one? The basic error of judgment. Anything that you want to add? Don't mix up Yeravam ben Nevat and Rechavam ben Shlomo. Two names which were put into the Bible to confuse you and always confused me for many years. Don't get them mixed up. Rechavam, the son of Shlomo. Remember the story with him, that he asked for advice what to do, because part of the reason the kingdom split was because he was unfortunately not very amenable to people who gave him good advice. The Zakenim, it says he asked the Yeladim. Yeladim mean the people, his contemporaries. He was not a youngster. He was already, you know, well into his 20s, one would believe, maybe even his 30s. But the advisors are called Yeladim because they behave like children. They said to him, if Shlomo, your father, gave taxation in such a severe way, you make it even more severe. The people are not listening to you, make it even tougher, so that they will listen to you. All right? And of course, that was clearly not the way to go, but he listened to them. They were his chaver. They were his contemporaries. There's a bit of a sort of a musa there as well about when to listen to advice and when not to. So I think that's as much as I want to say on number one. Any comments anyone wants to add about Yeravam? In which case, let's go to number two, which is all part of the same discussion, which is the character regarding King David. This wonderful midrashic comparison. In fact, it's found in the Gemara as well. I think it's in Gemara. We just learned it recently in Daf Yomi. I think it's Gemara Makkah, but I'm not. Don't remember now which page. And the whole discussion about David and Yeravam going for a walk in the Garden of Eden. Yeravam was not, at the beginning, disowned by God. There was always a chance of Yeravam doing tshuva. And the Gemara presents it, the Talmud presents it, Midrash presents it, in the form of the following meeting between God, Yeravam, and King David. And Hashem says to Yeravam that you have a chance to repent. I want to take you back into the circle of tzaddikim, but we have to go in for a walk in the Garden of Eden with David HaMelech. And of course, Yeravam's immediate question was, who goes first? I hope you remember that. Right? And what was the answer? Obviously, King David. So what does Yeravam say? No thanks, but no thanks. If I'm not going first, then I don't want to go. So even if this is a theoretical discussion, it obviously reveals to us one of the great psychological analyses of Yeravam's character, and that was a very extreme ego. Everything revolved around him, okay? And this became very difficult. In other words, apart from the national agenda, which he must have had, becoming king of the north of Israel, there was also a very severe dose of, it's either egoism or egotism, I can't remember which is which, and as a consequence of it, he was impossible to deal with. By the time you get to the end of Yeravam's reign, there is more war and bloodshed between the north and the south of Israel than there ever was in previous times, or hopefully, let's put it this way, than there will ever be ever again. The amount of soldiers that were involved in battles between north and south, we saw those quotations, you have a handout about it, that it went over 1 million soldiers. Okay? Really quite scary in the number of people that were killed, all because of some of Yeravam's characteristics. I'm not saying Rechavam was a big tzaddik. Clearly he had also his own issues. I am the son of Shlomo, therefore I am the greatest thing since Shlomo HaMelech. And he wasn't quite the greatest thing since Shlomo HaMelech, by the very fact of not listening to good advice. His mother was also Na'ama, Ammonit. Remember, Shlomo never married a nice Jewish girl from anywhere. All his wives were daughters and princesses of nations from the Middle East. And he married them, and the Rambam says he converted them. We always made the comment when we talk about that, what sort of conversion it was. Not really a conversion that nowadays probably will be thrown out of court, Jewish court, but in those days was enough. They would go for a little swim in the River Jordan, and that would be it. Did they light Shabbos candles? The answer is, I've always maintained, no, because I don't think they would ever have learned about it. Shlomo probably lit the candles himself, or Batsheva, his mum, but that was it. So when we're dealing with the whole question of back to Yeravam, in comparison to King David, we're talking about really the total opposite of King David. King David, a man who was totally for the people, and Yeravam, who was totally for himself. Okay, so that's number two. And that particular discussion about Yeravam and David HaMelech walking in the Garden of Eden is really one of the most powerful images of the whole Yeravam episode. I think that's really something worth knowing. Any comments, anything you want to add? Everyone's being very well behaved today, not chipping in. Let's get through it. Number three, the basic ideas of idolatry and why they were so powerful. We've spoken about this a number of times, and I want to go over it very quickly. What did idolatry represent? The forces of, finish the sentence, the forces of the N-word, not the forces of evil, but you're almost there because that's the Star Wars interpretation. The forces of nature. Okay, the forces of nature. What I mean by that is that in the world there is a natural order, and we as Jews always talk about the Yad Hashem, the hand of God, Hashkacha Pratit, in control of the natural order. But idolatry seems to have been not just an intermediary. It wasn't just a fanciful, you know, sort of attempt to sort of be kind of hip and modern about what they were doing in those days. This was a real deal. And the Malbim says it very, very clearly. He says that idolatry was real. They would, I suppose the way I've always explained it is that it's a kind of insurance policy. If the crop fails because their relationship to God is not what it should be, then you go to plan B. And plan B is you start doing idolatry, like sheiras and all the stuff, and all of it is very fertility-based. A lot of sexuality goes into all the idolatrous practices because that's what it's about. It's about fertility, about production, fruit production, okay, and food production. And part of that is, and the practices are described in Sefer Melachim, are grotesque in the extreme. Grotesque beyond belief. But that's part of their cult because they believe the more you indulged in these types of very primitive sort of sexual practices, it would bring about more fertility in nature. And that's what they were looking for, to increase the power of nature to produce crops. Now, whether the crops were produced in the end is speculative. We're not really told one way or the other, but no question about it, says the Malbim, this was a real awareness. And idolatry for Am Yisrael became a real challenge, something that was part of their Yetzer Hara, right? Nowadays we talk about the Karch of Arayot, the whole idea of immorality, of sexuality is a very deep desire which is found in the human condition. That in once upon a time, idolatry was as incredibly overpowering as those other forces are to this very day. And the reality of it was that because of it, the people just could not resist. Once idolatry took hold, it's almost as if they would forget the origin of the species, as it were, the origin of where things came from in terms of God, and they would be in totally what's the word, they will be totally bound by the laws of the idolatrous practice. And we see this becomes more and more difficult. Yeravam pushes it, and everyone after him is even worse than Yeravam. He says that you even were worse, you know, he talks about Achav, even than the house of Basha, and he was worse than the house of Yeravam. Things got from bad to worse. So there's no question about the whole idea of idolatry and the power of idolatry. You can always mention the famous discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. I think it's a page, either page 102 or 103, I don't remember now. Came up in the Gemara study recently. And the Gemara says so clearly that when it comes to Yeravam, he and the whole idea of what he got up to, and later on with other idolatrous, Manasseh and people like that, they the Gemara says that they were teaching laws of the Torah, right? This is something, again, the contradiction we have with Achav is with other men as well. And the Gemara says, one of the rabbis of the Talmud, who lived obviously much, much later than any of these kings, he says, well, these are bad men. And one of them came to him in a dream. I think it's Manasseh who came to Abaye, one of the rabbis of the Talmud, and says, dear rabbi, if you'd lived in my generation, you would have run to the idolatry quicker than anybody else. You have no idea how incredibly overwhelming the desire to do idolatry really was. The Gemara explains that that desire was removed. The rabbis prayed that that would disappear at the beginning of the Second Temple, because of idolatry, the First Temple was basically destroyed, and they didn't want it to happen again. So idolatry went away, and as I've explained, because of the way the world lives in a balance between good and evil, idolatry went away on one side, and prophecy seems to have gone away on the other side. All right, so that was the price that we paid by the sort of first couple of years of the Second Temple. Prophets no longer existed. Quite interesting. Does idolatry exist in other parts of the world today? The answer is, yeah, of course it does. But for Am Yisrael, no longer a problem, thank God. Okay, we don't have to worry about people pulling out little images from their pocket. Nowadays it's iPhones and who knows what, but not little pictures of cows and donkeys and whatever other things they might have worshipped. Who knows? Is the iPhone idolatrous? I don't want to get into that discussion. It may very well be, but don't want to talk about that. Let's go on. Number four. Any questions, by the way? Any comments? Right. I mentioned to you once my visit to the British Museum, which, Yaffa, if you go to London, you've got to do this one day. I was told you've got to be careful when you read the inscription next to the idol, because they've got images of everything there. You have to sort of lean a bit to the side, because reading the inscription bowing forward is like an act of bowing to the idol. Not a good thing to do, even in the year 2017. So you're encouraged to sort of read it, but read it kind of from the side and not head on. And it's worth it. One of the other things they have at the British Museum is this fantastic wall painting. It's not really a painting, it's more of a sculpture of Esther and Ahasuerus. And Queen Esther is not the ravishing, beautiful sort of, you know, presentation that we have in our mind's eye. She's rather more like a Rubens painting. If you know Rubens, you know what I'm referring to. Okay, a bit more rotund and a bit more sort of Middle Eastern than we normally picture, but it's worth seeing that particular image. You might be able to even see pictures of it online, I don't know. The whole image of Esther and Ahasuerus, fascinating. British Museum, gotta go. It's one of those places you have to go to. Number four, more kings in the north than there are in the south. Why? Right? We had the description, we went through it very quickly, of the turmoil, as you say, the Yiddish expression, the tumult, okay, the incredible upheaval of the north. It got to a point where you had 12 kings in the south of Israel. In the equivalent period in the north, there were 20 kings, almost twice as much, certainly, you know, 1.5 times as much, if not more, than in the south. Why was there such a big turmoil? Because the rules of dynasty had disappeared in the north. Anyone who came along and wanted to take the throne seems to have had the ability to do so. If he had the following, a guy called Zimri, 7 days, king for 7 days. After 7 days, he went and committed suicide. He obviously decided this was not a good job for anyone, especially for himself, and he killed himself. Unbelievable stories. What happens in the north also is that the further away you are from Yerushalayim, from the center of holiness, then the less stability there seems to be within the ranks of kings, and I have to add queens. because in the north there is the invention of something called a Queen of Israel, which was not the original mitzvah, but unfortunately came from Jezebel and her daughter Atalia, who is certainly a character that features in Malachim Bet. If her mother was bad, she was maybe in certain ways even worse. So there's no question, more kings in the north, a sign of less stability, less holiness, less dynasty. What was dynasty all about when the kings were established? One of the rules of kingship was that the king is dead, long live the king, the son takes over, and then the son, grandson, etc., etc. Rules of kingship. All of that was basically thrown out of the window in the northern kingdom. Okay? Yeravam in the end, although I think his son does take over, but eventually you get different people, their power struggles, politics galore, and people become kings who really are not fitting for the job, except that they seem to be more powerful than the other guy. It's all about, you know, a bit like Washington, pardon me saying so. I shouldn't have said that, but I guess I have to say. Modern comparison. Should some of these people be running the country? Make up your own mind, I'm not sure. Civil wars, number five. Sefer Melachim and Divrei Yamim. So again, I think there's a handout just to show you the numbers that were involved, the outrageous level of fighting that was going on between north and south, right? Millions of people were involved in these battles. How scary was that? And there were certain points during those periods, the early period of the north and south kingdom, where the two kingdoms could have come together. King Asa, one of the good guys in the south, was at a certain point trying to bring the north and the south together, and it never happened. Once the split took place, it was never repaired. And the tragedy was, much later in Jewish history, when the Assyrians, Ashur, came to take over Eretz Israel. They fought against the Jews living in Israel. They took over the northern kingdom, right, in the year 722, but they failed to take over the southern kingdom. So the northern kingdom was less stable, and in the end was less able to put up a resistance when the enemy finally came to take them into exile. And this is a pretty shocking thought. This is where most of the lost 10 tribes went. Some of them we know are back, the Ethiopians, tribe of Dan. There are some that claim from India to be a tribe of Manasseh, and various other places, even the American Indians seem to have some sort of claim as being one of the lost tribes of Israel. Not quite sure which tribe they are, but who knows. And all of this is really very, very sad in terms of the history of the day, because it was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare of what happened to the north as opposed to the south. And again, stability, closeness to the spiritual center of the Jewish world, which still is Jerusalem, even though I guess some of you saw the news item today that over 100 countries voted against the American resolution in the United Nations to accept Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Over 100 countries. How many countries in the United Nations? I think it's 190 or something. And two-thirds of that group went against the American decision to adopt Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It's a pretty stark reminder of our situation in the world. Nothing really changes when it comes to that, right? We have it in the Torah, in Am Levadad Yishkon. We always dwell on our own. We have the Americans backing us up, but even there, certain presidents were much better, certain presidents were not much good. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, there's a lot to be said, this idea of being on our own, right? Because it's really us and God. We have our partner in heaven, and that's it. And if one doesn't believe in God after studying Jewish history, then I'm not quite sure who your teacher was, but you need to get a better teacher. Because no question, when you study the history of the Jewish people, their survival, everything about Jewish survival, Jewish history, just confirms the existence of God, right? The Yavetz, I think, the famous Yaakov Emden, very famous rabbi 300 years ago, he says, look, there were great miracles in the Bible, great miracles in the Torah, but he said the greatest nace of the last 1500 years, since he was writing 300 or 400 years ago, greatest nace of the last 1600 years has been the fact that we're still around telling the story. That has been a miracle which, he says, nobody can explain. One explanation, that we have a close relationship to God. We survive. The Crusades, Khmelnytsky and all these horrible things, and now in our generation, the Holocaust. Quite remarkable. And here we are, starting Startup Nation, you know, sort of going into the stock exchange yesterday, if you saw the pictures. Israel was invited, one of the companies, to open the session in Wall Street, or I think maybe in London, I don't know which one it was. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. And the Jews are back, you know, at least certainly in terms of business and all of that. And wow, don't know what to say. Jewish history is a very, very interesting thing to look at, you know, sort of long term as well as short term. Civil wars, so we've discussed that. Number six, anyone wants to add anything to that? Look at the handout, the references there. Again, don't really need to do much more than just to show that, you know, you have some awareness of what was going on in the Northern Kingdom, and particularly in relation to the Southern Kingdom, and how this was an ongoing battle, and how sad it was. Right? Whenever it's being referred to in the Psukim, it always seems to be a kind of refrain, a kind of dirge, a sadness. Right? That Bayomahim Milchama Bein Zeh Ubein Zeh. In those days, the war continued between this one and this one, between this king and that king. And it's so sad. It's just one of those things. Jews really should have learned the lesson a long time ago that we're at our strongest when we talk to each other, and we're at our weakest when we fight with each other. And try and explain that to some of the people in Israel today. I wish they would get it. That's another discussion for another time. Number six, Elijah and Pinchas, the Ralbag's analysis. This is a great topic to discuss, to have a question on. No question in my mind that this is a good one. What did we say? That there is a tradition, a rabbinic tradition, that Eliyahu doesn't seem to have been born anywhere. We don't have any information about his early life, right? Pinchas doesn't seem to have died, not recorded anyway, as opposed to lots of other people where it is recorded. So the rabbis say, let's look at their lifestyles, look at the way that they present themselves in Jewish history, their character, their everything about them, the language that is used, right? The Ralbag gives a whole bunch of examples where it uses the same wording, describing Pinchas as it does describing Eliyahu. And as far as the Ralbag is concerned, all of that proves the point that Eliyahu and Pinchas are one and the same. And this, of course, as I mentioned at the time, is particularly interesting coming from the Ralbag, who seems to be a person, again, you can sort of study this in another context, if you do Middle Ages. Excuse me, but the Ralbag was famous for being a rationalist. Okay, and yet when it comes to this discussion, this is about as far from rational observation as you could possibly imagine, because you're basically saying that there is a person who never died, right? Eliyahu just continued the life of Pinchas. There's even an interesting discussion, did Eliyahu have the status of a Kohen? If he's Pinchas, then he's got to become a Kohen, all right? Which again makes some interesting differences with the whole discussion we had about the wife of Eliyahu, right? Which is one of my favorite topics. What happened to the wife of Eliyahu? And one of the points of discussion is that if Eliyahu is a Kohen, right, and the wife of Eliyahu now claims that he's gone and he's dead and he turns up again and she wants to be with him again, right, there may be a problem because of a Kohen not allowed to remarry under certain circumstances. Okay, obviously it's not going to be a case of divorce, but there may be other restrictions on their relationship, you know, things like that, which are very good theoretical points. Whether this is a practical discussion, I believe not, because we have no evidence that Eliyahu got married. But doesn't matter; keeps the rabbis happy because they write books on this stuff, as I mentioned to you. One thing I just want to add with the introduction to Elijah, which I think is important, is the whole question of his appearance at the Shiva call, right? We did go into the whole Midrashic explanation of what happened, because Elijah kind of appears out of nowhere, and he goes to visit a guy called Chiel, and he doesn't want to go. Elijah says, I don't want to go. I know they're going to be making fun of me or making fun of God. I just don't want to go. Hashem says, but you got to go. You represent the voice of truth in Israel. So go along. So we've got this scenario, again, only Rabbinic Judaism can come up with, which is this gentleman sitting Shiva, for having disobeyed the curse of Yeshua. He rebuilds Jericho, and he is sitting in front of him. On one side is King Achab, who is making a Shiva call, very interesting, and on the other side is none other than Elijah. That must have been a pretty hot discussion. And here they are sitting together, and the discussion inevitably goes to the attributes of God, and the two gentlemen, Chiel and Achav, start talking about the fact that God does not enforce the drought, which he promises in the Bible, right? So, because the question is, why did Chiel ignore the curse that Yeshua put on someone rebuilding Jericho? He lost his children, he was crazy, but he ignored it. So his answer was, but if God does not do what he's promised to do in Sefer Devarim, to close up the heaven and not have rain, then why should I worry about the curse of a student when the master's curse doesn't take place? I wasn't worried about Yeshua, I didn't take it seriously, right? And that was Chiel's excuse. And the answer which Elijah says is, of course, that I will show you immediately that Hashem's curse is to be taken seriously, and as the rabbis put it, he received from God the key of rain, whatever that means, the ability to affect the rain, and there is a drought in Eretz Israel for 3 years. And this is all chapter 17. What happens during those 3 years is pretty disastrous for the Jewish people. People are dying, a drought in Israel. This year they've announced that people should daven for rain again because they haven't had enough rain. So this is a constant issue in Eretz Israel. In Shema Kolein, if you have the Israeli Siddur, the one Rinat Yisrael, or any of the Israeli Siddurim, they have a special paragraph which you say during the winter months if there has not been enough rain in Israel. At the moment, the weather in Israel is very temperate, it's very nice, not as cold as it is here. But they do need the rain. So rain is a constant issue. But to deny the Jewish people rain, that's extreme. And Elio is the black and white guy. He doesn't see anything more than, if you deserve it, then you deserve it. If you don't, then you don't. If you're bad people, you'll get a bad punishment. If you're good people, you'll get a good reward. He doesn't have that sense of patience. Not that sense of understanding, making sure that Am Yisrael are treated in a way which is a way of God, which is to wait for them to do tshuva. Elio is not built like that. And therefore, Elio has to go through a process of understanding the Jewish people. One of the early stories, which is not on the list here, but you can always bring into a discussion, is the revival of the child, right, who traditionally became Yonah Hanavi. We did mention that. He became the prophet Jonah. And Eliyahu's ability to bring that about is the beginning of the process of feeling the pain of the Jewish people. The child had died because of the lack of food, the lack of sustenance. The mother just could not feed the child anymore. Child had died, and Elio was involved in bringing the child back to life. And the mother complains that Elio brought this about on her, and therefore Elio felt obligated to do something about it. And he does, but at the same time, it is a beginning of Elio's becoming more connected to Am Yisrael, to the Jewish people, and their pain and suffering. And this, of course, becomes a work in progress for Elio right throughout his short life that we're told about in the Bible, and in the long period of time that he's been with us, where he visits every house on Pesach, he goes to every Brit Milah, he's there according to the Sephardi tradition, every Matzoi Shabbat, they sing about Elio Navi, and he's always around. He is a fixture in our lives, right? And it's not only that he's a fixture in our lives, but we've got to become a fixture in his life. One other thing that I forgot to mention about Elio and Pinchas is the wonderful tradition that Elio answers all of our questions, all of our Talmudic problems that we have in conclusion to many, many discussions in the Gemara. Elio will sort it all out because Elio is Pinchas. Pinchas was there when the Torah was given. Pinchas heard the undiluted version of Torah law. So when we come along thousands of years later and we want an answer, and Elio comes to accompany Mashiach, as we're told, one of the jobs Elio will do is to go to the heads of the yeshivot, the carriers of the tradition, and say to them, now I want to go through all of the takers, all of the question marks in the Gemara, and give you the answer to these questions. And there's not really one section of Gemara which doesn't have some reference to Elio answering our questions. The expression the Gemara uses, Teku, Taf, Yud, Kuf, Va. And this stands for Tishbi, Elio, he's a Tishbi, Yud Tarets will give us the answer, Kushyot, Kuf, Vav is Bayot, Baya, Ma Baya. right? Answer our problems and our questions. Eliyahu is going to do that. That's going to be his job. And he can do it because he's been first. He was around the first time when the Torah was given. He knows the answers. Alright, so that's Eliyahu. The events of Har Carmel. This is again a whole story into itself. And obviously the mechanics of the story, I'm sure you all know. And I'm not going to go over that. But one or two things that we did ask, how was it allowed? And what is the question? Because the law is that a Mizbeah cannot be built outside Jerusalem. Right? Once the temple is built, you can't do sacrifices outside Yerushalayim. So how can this be allowed? How did the whole episode come about? And the answer, which we said, is an answer given for a number of situations in the Bible called Avera Lishma. Right? Anybody want to be brave? What was Avera Lishma? You were allowed to do a sin for the sake of God. Under what circumstance? Not just because, you know, it takes your fancy, but because, what does it achieve in the end? Sin for the sake of God in order to, what does Eliyahu achieve? To bring recognition,
to be makarit
people, to essentially bring about a salvation for the Jewish people. Okay, for the traditional Jew. He wants the traditional Jew to be vindicated against the prophets of Baal, and he's allowed to do it. As did Shaul when he went to ask the witch of Endor. Again, a sin for the sake of God. He wanted to know what was going to be. Esther, when she lives with Ahasuerus, she's living with a married man, and not only that, but she, according to the Bible, according to the Talmud, is married to Mordechai, right? Which is, makes it even worse. She's a married woman who's gone off to live with a non-Jewish guy. And, you know, a lot of examples. Yael with Sisera, all of those types of situations, they're all Avera Lishma, and the reason why they are allowed is because they all involve some sort of salvation for the Jewish people. Right, Esther, Queen Esther, is living with Ahasuerus to ensure that the Jewish people are given a place once again in the Persian king. They're not thrown out. Okay, and here Eliyahu is trying to save the reputation of the God of Israel in the face of idolatrous practice. Okay, number 8, King Ahab. His character is seen in the story of Navot, interactions with Eliyahu, his religious outlook. The religious outlook is something that we talked about right at the beginning. When we started with Achon, he had a Sefer Torah, right? And he seems to have had a lot of respect for it. That's one of the quotations I mentioned. Chapter 20, verse 6, where it talks about his Sefer Torah. Rashi brings it there. And what I want you to be aware of is the outlook, the religious outlook of King Achon. What did we call him? What sort of type of outlook did he have? Do you remember what it was? Sorry? He's not black and white, that's Eliyahu. Achav is much more about, how, what word are we going to use? Begins with a U. Uni, not university, but almost the same word. He's like into universalism. He sees that everyone is connected, the brotherhood of man. Right? One of those 60s groups of singers that probably are now all in old age homes. I don't know where they are. The brotherhood of man. Maybe I'm making that up, but I don't think I am. I think there was a group like that. What we have is this attitude that Achav sees the God of Israel. He doesn't deny Hashem, but he sees Hashem as one of many. And of course, what does that mean? That if we're all into gods with a small g and an s at the end, plural, then we can marry whoever we want because you've got your God, I've got my God. Jezebel, you've got Baal, I've got the God of Israel. But you know what? I'm not going to reject Baal because of my allegiance to the God of Israel. And of course, what happens in the end is complete and utter chaos and pandemonium. Because Jezebel brings the cult of Baal, Asherah into Eretz Israel, and it becomes overwhelming. It is so intense that it says that how many, I think it says how many people in the end remained loyal to the God of Israel properly, 7,000. 7,000, which is not a big number. Okay, nowadays when we talk about the number of religious people in Israel, we're talking about millions. Those days, 7,000 in the north of Israel. Quite extraordinary. All of that is, again, highlighting the behavior of Achav and the challenge that he failed to sort of resolve in his own life. The challenge of trying to understand that the God of Israel represents a higher level of God in the world, the level of God in the world. Not just higher, but the level. Okay? Everything else is a poor imitation or nothing at all. And of course, what happens here, as we said, the story of Navot is one of those stories where Achav tries to take over the land, right? We did talk about it. If you remember, we suggested that Achav maybe was not so much in the wrong for doing it, because the king is allowed to access your land if he wants to. But there were a number of objections to what Achav was doing. Do you remember some of the objections? This is really worth reviewing. What did we say? That he couldn't take over the land because... what was he going to use it for? That's one of my favorite objections. Avodah Zarah, right? And if he's using Avodah Zarah, then forget about it. That's unacceptable.
And it was an inherited land, so he didn't have the royal right to it.
Excellent. He's only allowed to take over acquired territory, not inherited land. Right? So that's another objection, why Acha was not really entitled to do what he did. We also say that's a privilege of the king of Israel. Was he the king of the whole of Israel? No. King of the north of Israel. So he didn't really have that title, which he needed to be able to do that.
So even if it was an inherited land, he didn't technically have a right to it.
Correct.
The law of Kings Roshul means it also invalidates the whole route that Yezebel took. That was kind of similar to David's route of getting rid of Bathsheba's husband.
Absolutely. But not the way to go. And there's a lot to say about that, but that will be for another occasion.
Like, he technically had a right to that route, though he was kind of castigated for it. But we're saying that because Ahab was king of only half, he didn't have even that right.
Even that right, correct, correct. And of course, what happens in the end is that Jezebel arranges the demise of Navot, and Ahab is pretty devastated about the whole story, and there is this sense that at last Ahab is beginning to have remorse, the beginnings of Teshuvah. And of course, what I want to say about Ahab, which is so precious, is what happens in his final battle. The rabbis asked, why did Achav succeed in battle so much? And the rest of the battles, like with King David, they were mixed. They're not always successful. And Achav seems to have been more successful. And there's two things that I want to add to that discussion. Number one is the sense of Achav himself being Leman Ha'am Va'aretz. All right? Something that, by the way, we also mentioned with his father, Omri. Remember, we said about Omri that he established a town in Israel. He established the town of Shomron. And that in itself was something incredible. We spoke at that time, when we went through that, the merit of Omri was very strange, because he was, again, big idolatrous person. But he was in Eretz Israel, establishing part of Eretz Israel for the Jewish people. And that in itself, we spoke about Rav Kook, and the way that Rav Kook used to deal with that particular question of the early Chalutzim, who were not observant Jews, but were redeeming the land of Israel. And Rav Kook cannot praise them highly enough, because he saw them like an Omri type character. They don't observe, but they are redeeming, they are building the land of Israel. That's their mitzvah. And that became something which Omri did. And we saw with Achav, his commitment to Am Yisrael was to the bitter end. He's standing in his chariot, he's already been hit by arrows, he's bleeding to death, and he doesn't allow anyone to let him sit down in the chariot, that he won't be seen. He needs to be seen at the battle so that the Jews can win. And they win. They win. And he becomes the flagship for the Jewish people, even though in his own personal observance he was clearly on the wrong track. So very interesting. Achav certainly is something which I hope will give you lots of joy to write about, because there's going to be something about him. You know, just listen to what we're talking about. You'll get some idea. Number 9, we're almost finished. Number 9, the analysis of Eliyahu and his life and reputation. His epiphany. Epiphany of Eliyahu, chapter 19. Right? He goes to Mount Sinai, or Horeb as it's called, and he wants to die. Right? He's had an epiphany. His epiphany means that he's woken up to the fact that the world is not going to change. He thought it was going to change after the story of Carmel, and on the contrary, instead of changing, it got worse. Right, Jezebel puts out a fatwa, as they say nowadays. She wants him dead, and he has to run away for his life, and he's off down south. He doesn't even stay in the north of Israel anymore. He goes back to Har Horeb. He finds out where Mount Sinai is. We don't know nowadays where it is, but he knew. And he goes to God, and he says, Hashem, I want to check out. I want to go back to Shemayim. Hashem says, Malach HaBoliyo, what are you doing here? You still got work to do. You've got someone to, you've got to find your successor. You've got to go and anoint kings. You've got still stuff to do. Alright? Don't be so quick to check out from this world. Eliyo, yesh malasot. And Eliyo struggles with that particular concept. Malach HaBoliyo, it says twice. What are you doing, Eliyo? Eliyo is being asked by God, understand that you're developing a character, which I know at the moment is particularly black and white, but we're trying to sort of take the edges off a little bit. We're trying to get you more connected to the Jewish people, to the King of Israel, and to the people of Israel. And of course, once Eliyo checks out properly, his whole future is going to be interacting with Am Yisrael. He's the Malach, whether the body stays in Shemayim, whether the body goes somewhere, right? We spoke about that on Tuesday. That's all what I wrote over here. The demise of Eliyo, connection with fire, angel or man. You can certainly write a whole bunch of stuff about that, which we spoke about, the different opinions that we went through on Tuesday. And finally, Eliyo, work in progress, the guardian of oral law, as I mentioned. He's the one who comes with Mashiach to announce the redemption of the world, because he is the guardian of tradition. There is no question about it. He will come back and try and put us straight. Okay, so much is said in the name of traditional Judaism, which is not traditional. And Eliyo will come along and hopefully give us the unadulterated version of what Torah was and is meant to be. Doesn't mean that everything new will be rejected, but it means that my feeling about it is it will be clarified. Okay, maybe women rabbis, in the end of the day, may be a very acceptable thing. Who knows? Eliyo may be able to give us some guidance on these controversial issues of the 21st century, even in the Orthodox world. Any final comments? Any thoughts? Everyone's been sort of, what the word is, sort of forced into silence here. You all look very blank. No, not even a smile. Not complete, sort of comatose.
It's
finals. Yeah, I do get it. On the other hand, we've learned something so, so special. I just want to emphasize that again, to have the privilege. I always feel it's a real privilege to be able to share, to learn about Eliyahu Navi, someone who we all know about, but we know nothing about. It's one of those things in Jewish life that we know about so many things in Jewish history or in Jewish awareness, and we know nothing about it. And Eliyahu Navi is a classic example. We know about Eliyahu Navi, we sing about it. Go to a Brit, go to a Sfardi, Malava Malkin, you'll hear about Eliyahu Navi the whole time. But we know nothing about it. Who was he? What was he about? What did he do? What? How did he live his life? How did he die? Did he die? Michtam Eliyo. There's a letter coming, later on from Eliyo. What's the whole thing? What's the tradition of Gilui Eliyo? I spoke about that on Tuesday. People see Eliyo. Who is he? What is it really about? And once we actually have the privilege of studying it, we can come to a better awareness of why this person in his own way represents, not necessarily the Dugma Ishid, the person that we have to follow, because of the way that he conducts himself, but he becomes like the inspiration for us in so many ways. All right, he sticks to his guns. He does become more user-friendly, no question about that. But he's also the man of tradition. He stays with the tradition. And that's something which I think we really need to look up to. Even Achon, at the end of the day, are we going to be critical of him? He doesn't get Olam Haba. He did idolatry. He forfeited the world to come. But does he lose everything, from terms of what being a Jew is after a person leaves this world? I have to feel that that's not the case. I have to feel there's a lot of positive that we can throw into Achov's, afterlife. I really believe that. Even when we started off with Yeravam, all good intentions, but unfortunately the person's ego got in the way. How many people are like that? I don't even want to tell you. You know for yourselves already, I'm sure. All right, any final comments? Any thoughts? Everyone is kind of okay. All right, I'm glad you're all good with this. Again, any questions when you do your review? RebShaff@AOL.com. If you want to hear the lesson again, if you want to go through all these wonderful things, it's fabulous. I always love teaching Eliyahu. Then yutorah.org, and sing, it should be there. I hope I will get it already put online. I hope tomorrow, the latest. And in the meantime, good luck with the review. Good luck with exams. I apologize again for not being at the exam, but all being well, you should have your grades online you know, within the required time. And for those of you who are joining me next semester, which I hope some of you will, I look forward to seeing you again. And for those who are... Sorry?
I'm going to be in your judges class.
Oh, nice. Also good fun. For those who are not going to be with me, I wish you really lots of haslacha. And Bezrat Hashem, just, you know, the exam is a blip in your lives, and hopefully you'll get over it. And please God, you'll, you know, I hope you've gained something from this. I certainly have. And wish everybody well. This has been a great group. I really have enjoyed teaching this group. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Thank you very much.